anyway, yeah, and I've heard you said that to them, but, boy, this is off. I don't know if I should make this off the record or not. If I'm misquoting the poor guy, it's my fault. But Dom Crofton said to me one day, he quit attending the Jesus Seminar because they're all too far on the left, and they make, in his words, as I nearly as I recall, they make too many conclusions which are not weighted, are not anchored in the data.
He says this?
He told me that personally. Yeah,
Crofton
and I were together.
Says this?
He and I were together. I hear you. But he
Boy,
and
that's
I were
the
together.
Pot calling the kettle African American. I'm
well,
telling you.
There you go. But this is it. This was his third dialogue with Tom Wright. But where he did this. Anyway, I'm just saying these guys would surely. I mean, if you can bury Jesus in a shallow grave and the dogs can eat him, he would surely not affirm the creedal passage in 1 Corinthians 15 if he thought there were no reasons, or if he thought the reasons were on your side. But okay. This is...
I doubt if he's ever even considered the issue.
No, but this conclusion about 1 Corinthians 15:3, you could be the guy that topples it, but I'll tell you what, you'd have to look a long time to find an argument that's more widely accepted across the whole guild of liberal and conservative writers than the one that Paul's citing the creedal passage here.
Yes, but they are wrong, and
well,
I say that
be.
For a bunch of reasons.
But I
don't care
that.
If everybody else has said it. There are reasons for that, and I give the reasons that make it just clear to me that this is not Paul.
But, I mean, Bob, why do you end the article, I mean, if you're that convinced, by saying, quote, the case could never be more than unverifiable speculation, end quote?
Well, in the nature of the case, all of these arguments, the apologetic ones and the critical ones, are exercises in speculation. I it would be absurd to claim that we can know these things
we can't even agree
on exegesis.
But the reason the Guild of New Testament Scholars agrees against you, pretty much, doesn't make you wrong, but the reason the Guild agrees against you is they think the reasons are against you.
Well, then you have to show why that's the case. I have defended my article against Craig, for instance. Seems to me every one of the 7 or 8 arguments he gave is patently fallacious. I think that the arguments which go back earlier than me, I'm borrowing from Harnack and others, though they didn't see the big picture.
No,
I think the arguments are quite sound. I'd love to see somebody actually address them.
Because Harnack was a bit way over to the right from what you're saying. You know,
well, yeah, but he saw that, for instance, the ecumenical unifying, harmonizing character of the creed. He says it assumes that we're past a rivalry between James and the apostles
sure.
and Peter and the apostles. If that's the case, and it seems to me it is, we're not talking about the lifetime of Paul.
I don't understand why, but you know what? I've been talking too much. Richard, Mike, jump in here. Go ahead.
Well, we spent all the program, all the live program at least, talking mostly about whether or not 1 Corinthians 15 is authentically Paul, whether it's authentically
right.
something that was being passed on to him. I don't know if we want to take the time to sort of dive into any other areas. Obviously, there's plenty that we could get into. But let's... What if it is something that Paul was saying that was handed to him from other people, what makes their reports credible? I mean, all we're saying is, you know, if this is the reason we believe in the resurrection, we're saying we believe the resurrection happened because somebody said that to Paul. What makes Paul, what Paul was told, reliable?
Let me make the slightest comment, and I'll punt to Mike here, okay? My original comment that we started the show out when you asked me that question, I said... Basically, because if my thesis is correct, we have the right people at the right time. When you do ancient historiography, we are pleased sometimes to have reports that are only a few hundred years later. I mean, arguably the best-known biography of Alexander is written a full 4 centuries after Alexander. Now,
okay.
We pick at it, but we cite it too. And so when you get something at the 60-year mark, plus 60 after the cross, 60-ish, or you get Gospels maybe starting at 40 or 45, that's something to take note of. But then when you have Paul, apart from what Bob does with this 1 Corinthians 15, 3-11, you've got Paul affirming the resurrection, that he saw the resurrected Jesus elsewhere. Now Paul's writing in the 50s. Paul is preaching this since the 30s. I don't see hardly any dispute about that anywhere. So you got a guy who claims to be an eyewitness, Paul, who talks to 3 people who claim to be eyewitnesses, Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, and John. This is why, in my opinion...
Well, how do we know they did?
Did what?
Claim to Paul that they had seen the resurrected Jesus.
Well, for a couple things. I mean, for a couple things, Bob, I've been arguing that. I don't agree with your interpolation theory, but I would even refer to your own folks in the Acts of Jesus, the Jesus Seminar. They make the claim, 1 Corinthians 9:1, 1 Corinthians 15:8, I saw Jesus, is read. Yes, it basically happened. And then he appeared to Peter, first one on the list. He appeared to Peter. They make it, your colleagues, they make it pink.
A bunch of fundamentalists. Why do we
right.
have any... I mean, suppose Paul is quoting an earlier list. Do we know that came from Peter, James, and Cephas, and John, and so on?
Well, what we have is Paul's word, who not too many people want a dog.
I mean, suppose he believed it. Are we sure that's true?
Well, I mean, you can get in there with the spade, but
I mean, who said that they saw him? They didn't sign on this. It's a statement of faith.
Well, Bob, I mean, I think you say they didn't sign. I mean,
this is Paul, not them. I mean, even if Paul is quoting an earlier piece, did they write it? I mean, we don't have testimony from them.
I guess what I'm saying is Plutarch doesn't sign on Alexander either, but we cite him. And Tacitus is 80 years after Tiberius.
You're requiring that Paul is quoting people who we know to have seen Jesus. We don't know that. This is no different than the Gospels saying they saw him.
Well, I think it's a lot different, because in the Gospels, you would probably say that the Gospels are unanimously written. In the case of Paul's authentic epistles, you've got Paul.
If you're right, and this is a pre-Pauline creed, who wrote that?
My argument is that is a creed that was formalized before Paul came to faith.
Who wrote it? Where'd it come from? It might well be that he had been given, I don't think so, but it might be he had been given a formal statement. Who wrote it?
Well,
let's
put it this way. If, and you just used the word if, so if Peter, James, and or John, or all of them, if they passed that creed on to Paul at Jerusalem. Now, some
pure speculation could be, though.
Okay, Gerhard Ludemann, by the way, backs it up to Damascus. So, I mean, there are earlier possibilities. But if it comes from, because there are two individuals in the creed besides Paul, Peter and James. And by the way, he uses a great term there, Galatians 1:18, hysteresi, about there's been two non-evangelical studies that I know of that word in detail, arguing it's playing the role of an investigative reporter. So that's one more thing for Paul's trip to Galatians, playing the role inquiring of, as some translations say. He's picking at him, asking questions. But here's my point. If Peter, James, and John are passing this on to Paul, or just Peter and James in 35 AD, it doesn't make any difference who formalized it.
We don't even know that they passed it on. I mean, this is all surmise.
Okay, except this. Okay, here's the bottom. Okay, let me make these two points very briefly. The first one is, if they passed it on to him, it doesn't make any difference who wrote it. They must have approved it. And secondly,
waiting the whole thing on that.
Okay, then let's back up one step. Let's play the super critic here, and I'll play that with you. And you say, well, look, okay, so at best, there's a creedalized statement being passed around about the death and resurrection appearance of Jesus. Great. How do we know they gave it to Paul in 35 AD?
Right.
How do you know they gave him that? Okay, I would say we don't need to know that. I mean, this is in my writings. I'm not saying anything different. Maybe they didn't give it to him there. All I'm suggesting is that in Galatians 1 and again in Galatians 2, Paul lays before them the gospel message, and especially in Galatians 2, they affirmed it, which is also what we see in 1 Corinthians 15:11. It's also what we see when he says earlier in 1 Corinthians, Peter and Apollos and I are preaching the same message. So I'm not dying for the fact that this is a creed, or that Paul had to have gotten it in Jerusalem in 35 AD. But the content of the creed is what he must have heard. I just simply mean the death and resurrection of Christ. That must be what he heard, because that's specifically what he laid on the table, and that's specifically what they confirmed. It doesn't have to be in the creedal form, but they did affirm the data of the message.
You know, I would like to take this to a broader discussion now and get away just from Paul here. Paul's important, of course, but if we could just move to a little broader context. It's not just Paul who's testifying about the risen Jesus that we can trace it to. Of course, you got Paul. You've got some oral tradition and creeds, oral formulas, hymns, sermon summaries, and Acts, and so forth. You've got four biographies. We know we got those within the first century. Then we also have, at the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, we've got two of the apostolic fathers who are believed to have been disciples of the apostles. Clement of Rome, a disciple of Peter.
Anonymous.
Well, most scholars would...
It's anonymous. There's no name on it.
I know, but most...
It's got 60 chapters. Nobody wrote letters like that.
Bob, when do you date 1 Corinthians and Ignatius' epistles? When do you personally date them?
I think Calvin was right about Ignatius. It's a much later bunch of forgeries.
What's much later?
Oh, probably 175 or so. Maybe later than that.
And why would you put them that late? Yeah. And how could they be that late when Irenaeus mentions them in 170?
Well, because they would have been ecclesiastical official forgeries, and he himself was in that business, saying any crazy thing that came to mind and saying, well, all the elders from the East believe this.
And your evidence for that is what?
What's that?
Rather than just being a statement that you make to support your view, what is your evidence?
Well, the monarchical bishop, for one thing. That whole business. Everybody that discusses Ignatius says, boy, you know, where'd this come from so early as 117? Well, it didn't. It's way later.
That's just a speculation. That's just an
unsupported statement. As all of these things are, but that's the rules we generally look for. Where does it seem to fit in terms of the historical development of Christianity?
There are streams of tradition that are going along that intersect at various points. You got that with Eusebius. We have it with Irenaeus, who's earlier, of course. And you do have, like, First Clement. You've got Ignatius, who are quoting from New Testament both Paul's epistles and the Gospels that are appearing earlier. You've got Polycarp, who is referring to Paul's writings as well. And a lot of people are dating Polycarp, you know, quite early, like around his epistle, like in the first decade or the beginning of the second decade of the second century. So we've got these guys who are saying, hey, we knew the apostles, and this is what the apostles were telling us.
Gnostics said the same thing.
Right.
It was
true,
real
Tertullian
tempting to say
report,
that.
The Tertullian reported that even though the Gnostics were claiming this, they didn't have the records to back that up.
Well, neither do these guys.
Well, they did. They said, Tertullian said, we do have the records. You can see those. They're kept in the church archives today.
Yeah, so, that's easy to say. The Gnostics said the same kind of stuff. And in fact, we know what they were talking about. They're absurd compositions among the Nag Hammadi library, though those aren't authentic either.
Sure, but it doesn't say that... It doesn't say in those that they were having all this line of tradition that they could document. We do have that within the other one.
Well, they do say that. Look at any of these things, the Book of Thomas, the Contender, the Gospel of Thomas. This is written down by Judas Thomas, or Jesus said this to Judas, and I, Matthias, wrote it down, and Valentinus was the disciple of Theotus, who was the disciple of Paul. I mean, they have the same probably equally bogus line of succession claims.
They're claiming those things, but what the difference with Tertullian says, anybody can make claims, but we've got these things documented in the archives.
Where are the documents? I mean, everybody thought they had it documented.
Oh, I mean,
the Nag Hammadi texts are the documentation too. They're bogus.
But they weren't appealing to documentation. Anyway,
Those texts actually say.
Right, Tertullian
on this. So I want to pull this broader. So what we have, at least in my opinion, and I know that you're not concerned about where the majority of scholarship
is. All right, then we need to be kind of winding it down, by the way.
We have multiple independent testimonies that Jesus had been raised, and this comes not only from Paul, but it would come from those who said the disciples were saying, and others who said, hey, disciples said this.
These are guys that said, Paul founded my church, and that gives me authority over you, buddy. I mean, none of this is, as Martin Luther already correctly saw, the tradition had become a stinking swamp rather than a clear stream.
Right.
Well, let me ask you, Bob, what do you do with Paul? Because, you know, you spent a lot of time with him. talking about him, what do you do with the fact that he was not a believer? He was out persecuting the church, and now
I don't think that's true. In fact, everything, even if Paul did write some of the basics of the corpus assigned to him, most of that stuff is either in demonstrably late patches, as J.C. O'Neill and others showed in Galatians, or as I say in 1 Corinthians 15, or in the pastoral epistles, which are spurious. There's this stuff in Romans 16 where he refers to kinsmen who were in the Christian ministry before he was. That makes it sound like this guy did not enter Christianity from outside. And that here's a strange surviving fragment of a whole alternate background for Paul. I think the persecution thing came from a late misunderstanding of the Jewish Christian Ebionite or whatever polemic against Paul, that he was opposing the true Christian faith, namely theirs, Torah Christianity, and that in time, once you had this, as Bauer says, Catholicizing rapprochement, people began to think, oh, you mean Paul actually physically persecuted the Christians? And not thinking that it was just that he opposed Torah Christianity. I don't think he was a persecutor of Christians any more than I think Peter denied Jesus. I think these are the polemical smears of both sides in that conflict.
Besides 1 Corinthians 15, then, do you think that both Galatians 1 and Philippians 3, where Paul tells these things, do you think they're both bogus or interpolated?
Philippians is plainly, in my opinion, a kind of a fourth pastoral epistle. It's a famous last words thing filled with literary irony, presuming that the reader knows Paul died as a martyr and that...
In Galatians 1, 2, you say the same thing?
Galatians has more of a claim, in my opinion, to be authentic. But again, as I said an hour ago, I'm way out in left field because I accept Steck and Von Manen and these guys saying I don't think Galatians is kosher either.
Well,
if you have $50, you might want to check out my pre-Nicene New Testament where I go into all these crazy views. You can get it for $36 on Amazon. I wish I had extra copies to send you, but if anybody's insane enough to be interested in my crazy theories, you can find them all spewed out in that book.
Bob, one thing I like, I mean, you are very honest about the fact that virtually no living person agrees with you. I mean, I know there's a few here and there, but I find it strange that hearing your arguments, because, you know, you go to ARSBL and you're in the Jesus Seminar and you have access to these mainline guys, you know, on the left who do these sorts of things. How come you haven't won them over if they are already predisposed to give up what you give up?
Say that again.
A lot of your colleagues in the mainline scholarship, AARSBL, even some of your folks in the Jesus Seminar, who are not known for being very conservative, when those people are predisposed to say what, you know, to want to say, you know, for their first volume, one of their presuppositions is there's no such thing as resurrection. Okay, when they're predisposed to saying some of those things, I'm curious on why you think you haven't convinced almost anybody, even people who... Now, again, I want to make sure. Truth is not a head count proposition, but I'm saying...
No, that's what you're assuming here.
Trying to throw
me off the track and say not, clearly what you're saying.
No. Let me clearly tell you why I'm not saying that. I'm saying head count doesn't determine truth, okay? But why wouldn't you be able to use these arguments and convince folks who are very close to you ideologically, who already reject many of the things you reject, and you do have an audience with them? I'm not asking headcount. I'm asking, why isn't this headcount persuaded by arguments?
I don't know that very many of them have ever bothered to read any of my junk. I mean,
we would need to ask them, wouldn't we?
Pardon?
We would need to ask his colleagues that you're referring to.
Well, I guess we would, but what I mean is that they rub shoulders with Bob regularly, whether it's Jesus Seminar or AARSBL, and they see that these arguments are out there, And
I don't know. They may never have read them, but I don't mean to say I'm sure they would fall in line immediately if they did. But I know at the Jesus Seminar, when we had the Paul Seminar, when Daryl Dowdy and I both began to argue this way, we were looked at as if we were insane, and they started measuring us for straitjackets.
That's my point. You know what, Bob? You know what might be real strange about this? Maybe you're read more by evangelicals than you are by those guys.
Could be. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, in Kuhn's famous thing, The Structure of Scientific Revolution,
right,
he talks about how normative science is going to fight to the death to keep a hold of the regnant paradigm, and it's a good thing that they do, because you don't want any new proposal to win too easily. You want it to prove itself and win its spurs fighting against the old paradigm and trying to show how it can do a better job, and it can't show that if it's just accepted right off the bat. So it takes a long time, and because the old people have, the older scholars, the establishment, have done all their work with the game defined by certain rules, and they're not eager to throw the rules out. It doesn't mean they're acting in bad faith. We want them to act that way. That's how the game is played and how a victory of a new theory is going to mean anything worthwhile. So it might be that that's what's going on, but then again, any scientific creationist or chiropractor or Velikovsky could say the same thing, so, you know, and that doesn't prove a thing, but that's what I'm guessing.
It doesn't prove anything. I'm just curious why people who would take this move if they thought it was, I mean, I can't, Mike knows Elaine Pagels, Mike, or Bart Ehrman, or
this really isn't on the topic of resurrection, though. I'd really like to get back to Bob's reason.
Go right ahead.
We've already gone 85 minutes. We need to be wrapping it up pretty shortly here. So we have any,
and you're having fun.
Yeah, if we have any final thoughts, we could probably go ahead and go through those.
Bob, why don't you go ahead?
Well, I just think it's fascinating to kick the stuff around. That's the only way anybody, especially me, learns anything. And I'm just so tickled that you gents want to do that. I think it's a great experience, and I'd love to have more and more of it.
Thanks. Go ahead, Mike.
This was fun, Bob.
Hey, Mike, do you pastor a church in Marietta?
I do not. I work for the, I'm a director at the North American Mission Board, which is part of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Okay. You mentioned
something
about
your dissertation on, Mike?
I'm doing it on historiography and the resurrection of Jesus. So a little nuanced approach I'm taking is I've spent several years now studying just literature written by professional historians and how they actually do history and how they actually approach texts. How they come to historical knowledge, what is historical knowledge, when can you, what kind of criteria and processes do you have to go through in order to actually do a historical investigation? What criteria must be met? What kind of confidence do you have before something, a historian is justified or warranted in saying, well, this occurred in the past? And when they say that, what exactly do they mean by that? Because everything is held provisional. Provisionally. So been looking at that and just reading hundreds of articles and many, many books on the topic. So I've looked at and arrived at my historiography and how I'm going to approach things historically speaking. And to be honest with you, I know I'm the only one who could really verify this, but I've tried my best to realize that I have a very real bias. Having been brought up in a Christian family, going to a Christian university, involved in Christian ministry, that I have a bias. I want it to be true. Is that even possible to overcome? I don't think so. But how do you minimize it? Everybody has biases. It doesn't matter what you believe. Everybody has their bias. Everybody is plagued by that or hindered by it. How do you, in a sense, transcend that to a point where you can have some sort of, although not complete, at least you can have some sort of workable objectivity to come and look at these kind of texts, to look at the data? That's been hard for me to do. It's been something I've really, really wrestled with.
It's a tough question.
And then looking at what the data is, and then applying the method, which I've spent so much time looking at, and how, what kind of method is to be used, to apply that method to the data. And so that's what my dissertation's on.
You know, I wonder if the last thing you said is not an even more interesting dissertation topic.
of applying the message.
The will to believe. How can you set that? How can you bracket that while you're wearing this other hat?
Yeah, I agree with you, Bob. It's tough. I mean, you know, one thing I look at. Well, what if I came to the conclusion in the studies that Jesus didn't rise from the dead? Then I lose my good job.
But
so
wouldn't it just be that you were losing the ability to claim on historic evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, while you would still obviously be able to believe in it by faith?
Would you say that again? I'm sorry.
I mean, at most, it would seem like you would lose the ability to claim on historic grounds that Jesus rose from the dead, but you would still maintain the ability to believe so by faith.
Unless, that's a good point, unless there was an alternative hypothesis that seemed better, that it was a more plausible explanation than the resurrection hypothesis. Then there, you know, we'd look at that and say, well, is that better? You know, was it a hallucination? Or let's just say, because I'm not done my dissertation yet, I haven't got to the point of actually sitting down and really weighing through each of these hypotheses using the methods. I mean, you know, I can do that on a simplistic level, but have I really done it on this in this doctoral research? I haven't done that yet. So what if I got to the point and I said, okay, well, let's consider Bob's hypothesis here about how this is all just myth. And I looked at that and I said, wow, yeah, that just seems to fit the facts better. It fits the data better than the resurrection hypothesis. Well, then how could I continue to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead? It'd be difficult to do in my judgment.
That's true. Honestly, that's not what happened to me, but I was actually a Bible and theology major at Lee University up in Cleveland, Tennessee, before I left Christianity.
Were you in a Tomlinson church background? Church of God, Cleveland, Tennessee?
Actually, the church I came out of, the pastor came out of a Church of God background. He had kind of moved to a sort of non-denominational stance, but yeah.
Well, excuse me, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just asking Gary if he had any final thoughts.
Well, I've had plenty of final thoughts this whole program. I feel
right.
Like Bob and I have been like ignoring you guys. I won't speak for Bob,
okay.
At least I feel like that. I'm sorry about that, but I'll just say briefly, I'm the opposite. By the way, Richard, I do know where Lee is. My relatives live in that town. And I have two nieces who are graduates of Lee, so Lee University. In fact, one of my nieces was an All-American basketball player there at Lee University. But I would say I came in from the opposite direction. I was raised in a Christian home, but I threw it all up for grabs later in my life. And for 10 years, I was on a search. It centered on the resurrection. Bob, I probably told you this when we had that long talk in 1985, but I teetered. I mean, I played around with naturalism, whole nine yards, probably down there where you are, Bob. In fact, at one point, my mom called me and said, how are you coming with your doubts? And I told her I was a month or so away from leaving Christianity and from becoming a Buddhist. But I also did my dissertation. Mike, by the way, is being very humble here. He's not doing his dissertation at an evangelical school, so he's having to please some very critical people. And I did my dissertation on the resurrection of Michigan State. Most of the guys on my committee did not believe it. And I was going through all my doubts at that time. And so I came back the other way. I threw it up and said, can I know for sure? And I came back to affirm it and came back to the church that way after my little playing around with naturalism first and then Buddhism second.
By the way, Gary, is that dissertation, did you ever publish that?
It is published, well, in the sense that University Microfilms publishes it, and which is strange because I get royalty checks from it once in a while.
Wow, a lot of people
are buying my dissertation. Now, it's been a while since that's happened, but I mean, years ago, I sold 30 or 40 copies in a year for very heavy, you know, I mean, for dissertation type reading at a very heavy price. You know, I was very pleased with that.
Don't you want to get one of these people, you know, some publishing house to make it available?
Well, Bob, I mean, actually, since that time, I haven't published a lot of the stuff in my dissertation, but I've done 14 of my 27 books are on the resurrection, and they're not all evidential. Some of them are pastoral, and I've done some things in doubt and things like that. But I've probably brought a good deal of it out in one form or another other places. But, I mean, that is a good thought.
It seems like,
as you know, Bob, I sent my dissertation to three houses in those days, and I was a disillusioned 25-year-old, and I thought, surely because this is so brilliant, some publishers are going to want to publish this. And they wrote back to me, and they said, hey, listen, we're not judging whether this is right or wrong. We're judging that it's too heavy, and we're not going to make a buck.
They
specifically said to me, the managing editor, I won't tell you which company, but it's a very major company, they said, we're not trying to dog you, but we are a business, and if we don't make money, we won't be here to publish books, so we're going to have to say no. And after three tries of the dissertation, I was very disillusioned for a little while, and I actually told myself, this must be trash. Nobody will take it.
Oh.
And I didn't realize the difference between a company wanting it and a university saying it's good stuff. So, and that's where Mike is right now. So, and by the way, again, the guy's being humble, Mike. They are pushing his dissertation big time and want to get it published by a major press. And again, it's not a not an evangelical school. They're very impressed with his work in historiography.
Bravo.
Nice. All right, well, guys, it's 9:33 now. We've been at it for over an hour and a half. It's definitely been fun, though.
Oh, yeah, terrific. Yeah,
Richard, you were a very gracious host. Let us go on like this.
Yeah, no problem.
So
no problem.
Much for the job you did. Great to be with you, Richard.
All right, thanks for being on the show a second time, guys.
Hey, listen, maybe all four of us will be there in the April thing.
Yeah. I sure hope so.
Down in Atlanta.
Yeah, I certainly plan to be there.
Do we have a definite date for that?
Jim does. Jim Lazarus does. I might have it written down here.
Told me I can't.
The third
I must have it written down
In April.
Yeah, I put it down for April 20 and 21 is the date. I don't know if it's written in stone, but that's the date that Jim Lazarus gave me.
Oh, okay.
All right, great. All right, we can talk a little bit more about that off once we stop recording here. But, all right, thanks everybody for tuning in and downloading the program. This has been Gary Habermas and Mike Lycona and Dr. Bob Price. I always say, I'm in the habit of saying Dr. Bob Price, and I say Dr. Bob Price, and I feel like I have somehow sort of insulted the people who are also doctors.
True.
That's okay. No worries.
You know what I mean. All right. Mike, Gary, Bob, thanks for being on the program. And next week, I say, we've got Dennis McDonald appearing to talk about the Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark, and does the New Testament imitate Homer?
Great.
All right. Thanks, guys.